Hello and
Good.
welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is Joel. Actually, Joel's on assignment for this episode, and instead I have Justin Harrison from BMD, and that's an all-around cool guy.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So, I understand you've never done a podcast before.
This is podcast one. I'm toying with starting one about the infamously baffling and occasionally outright terrifying 1960s superhero cartoon Charge Man Ken, but we'll have to see if I'm any good in this format first.
It doesn't take much, just persistence, really.
Well, I have that at least, so.
Yeah. If you're
War on the Charge Man, coming sometime in the future, maybe.
I thought you were going to do one on, like, action movies. Like, what's his name? Scott something?
Scott Adkins?
Yeah, like his type stuff.
I'd like to do that, but I think having some structure would be good for a first-timer like me.
Oh, yeah. That would be good.
Maybe another podcast about action movies coming after that first podcast. We'll see. Yeah.
And if you ever do an episode on James Hong, one of my favorite actors, I would love to talk about James Hong and why he's amazing.
Weirdly enough, I'm wearing a Big Trouble Little China t-shirt with Lo Pan on it right now.
Oh, well, of course, because he's the best part of that movie.
He is wonderful.
All right, so we're probably going to cut most of it out. So,
sounds good.
this episode is the second half of the 1946 pairing. The first episode was on Kurosawa's No Regrets for Our Youth, starring the endlessly lovely Setsuko Hara. Have you ever seen anything with her?
I have not. I know that she had this really, really impressive run, then chose to retire and never looked back, so much so that her life was... Was she the inspiration for Millennium Actress?
Yes, she was. Yeah, she was the inspiration for the that movie.
Is she still alive? I feel like she might still be alive.
She died 2015.
So she was alive until pretty recently.
Yeah, she is a recluse from 1963 to her death. She refused photographs and interviews, so pretty much no one knew what was going on or anything, so...
But the filmmakers working during this time, in particular Mizoguchi and Ozu and Kurosawa, would be major influences on the generation who would make the new Hollywood films.
Oh, yeah. Someone named George Lucas is a big fan of Kurosawa, if you never noticed.
I had heard that there was maybe a little bit of a hint there, yeah.
Yeah, maybe Star Wars is directly inspired by a Kurosawa movie. Or maybe not, who knows.
Well, the only person would be George Lucas, and I guess Kurosawa's ghost.
Well, they were friends, actually. And
yeah, did Lucas produce... Was it Ron?
I don't know about Ron, because I haven't seen that yet. But he did Kagemusha and Dreams.
Yeah,
he let Kurosawa use... blue screen, industrial lights and magic stuff to do one segment.
Whatever else you can say about Lucas, the man champions what he likes. Even during Star Wars' bleakest period, he was...
So the other 1946 movie is Kenji Mizoguchi's Utamaro and His Five Women. And I'm not going to bother saying a Japanese title, or attempting to. But
it's a mouthful.
Yeah, a lot of them are. And Joel's better at that than I am, and he's on assignment.
Such is language. So this was the first Mizoguchi I had seen, and to prepare for it, I gave myself a little bit of a crash course in his life history. I read a few essays about this film. And the two things I think shocked to learn was, one, how much of Mizoguchi's film work is missing. Because he worked for quite a while before the war.
Yeah, he was in silent movies in, like, the early 20s.
Yeah, I think I read that it, like maybe a third of his work survives today, and it was someone on the.
That's generous. Like I thought it was even less than that.
I mean, he would have been extremely prolific when he was younger, but even though he was making films all throughout his life, as film got more complex, got harder and harder to just make a film off the cuff, especially in between the war and the occupation and everything after, never mind that Mizoguchi wasn't exactly the type to do fly-by-night films if he didn't have to, from what I'm gathering. The guy was an infamous perfectionist.
I don't know much about Mizoguchi. He's one I've not really... I've seen maybe six of his movies, but I haven't really done a deep dive into like learning a lot about him yet. Yeah.
Just from what I picked up on my little crash course, he was constantly concerned and angered by the reduction of women to second class citizens in Japan.
Yeah, he really championed telling women's stories, which really set him apart from pretty much every other like major Japanese director for a long time.
Yeah, and in Utamaru, all throughout, it's a recurring thing that outside of the title character, the men in the movie don't really think of women as people. You know, the main character's best friend proposes to a woman he's interested in and then immediately lobs cruel insults at her and is genuinely shocked when she takes offense.
Yeah.
From what I read about Utamaru in particular, this was the first film Mizoguchi made after the war, first film he made under the American occupation. And it was a bit of a feat for him to get it made at all, because during that occupation, historical films were all but banned under the assumption that if you had a samurai in your film, then clearly you must be promoting the kind of ultra-militaristic nationalism that Imperial Japan had practiced.
Yeah, so, that was an effect from 45 to 53 or 54. Yeah, it's kind of unclear when exactly it ended.
I guess once the occupation mutated into a different form, there was a little more artistic freedom. But if what I've read is accurate, he was able to sell the censors on the movie because his hero was very pointedly not a warrior. He never carried a sword. And in fact, in what might actually be my favorite part of the movie, he talks an artistic rival out of a sword duel because they're artists. It would be cowardly and unbecoming of them to just kill each other. They should wage war on canvas.
Yeah, and he says something to the effect of, violence is stupid. Why don't we just have an art duel?
And they do, and he doesn't even have to make his own painting. He just corrects his opponent's errors and leaves the poor guy sitting there for hours in shock.
And everyone leaves the room, and very pointedly, they say that he's drawing the goddess of mercy.
Yeah. His work inspires his rival so much that he not only quits his previous school to go work for tomorrow, he walks out on his fiancée and gets disowned by her father. It's this really, really interesting blend of the comic and the very, very sad, which runs throughout the movie, because...
Of the ones Mizoguchi's I've seen, this is the most lighthearted, which is kind of saying a lot, because the other ones are more bleak, and I won't say hopeless, but they are definitely darker and not as rewatchable. I could rewatch this.
I would definitely like to see this again, because from what I read, Mizoguchi basically never used close-ups. At the very least, I don't really think there were any in Utamaro that I can recall. He preferred to keep the camera at a distance to focus on bodies in a space, people interacting with each other, not in an intimate setting, but in public or with a god's eye view of the situation.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you're not just in Utamaro's head, although he is the connecting thread between what isn't quite a slice of life movie, but certainly kind of a vignette-driven series. The movie follows Utamaro and his relationships with the Title V women, who include courtesans and sex workers and the poor fiancé-to-be of his rival-turned-student. People who were very pointedly looked down upon by Japanese society at that time, who were considered not necessarily untouchable, but certainly not people you'd want to have in polite company.
Mizoguchi did make a point to, like, focus on lower class people. And, like, the other ones I've seen, that's a common theme of focusing a story on, like, a lower class family, in particular women. Because one, he cared about, women and people who were less fortunate, and also he saw it as a, not excuse, but, like, he saw it as, like, his duty, to an extent, to tell their stories, because their stories weren't being told by other directors, like Kurosawa, who kind of never really did. Like, I can't think of it. Well, there's maybe one, Dodeskaden, which is about, like, a poor neighborhood, and that's kind of, like, the only one I can think of that's really focused on, someone from the lowest class.
And Utamaro himself is, in film and in real life, he was a tremendously acclaimed and influential artist whose medium of choice was looked down upon, and partway through the movie nearly gets him kicked out of the country because he is making popular art for the masses that is easily obtainable and affordable, and importantly, not one of a kind. Utamaro finds great meaning and beauty in the women he befriends and who he seeks out as models, but that he chooses to use woodblock prints that can be copied and copied and copied and copied makes him at best questionable, especially when he starts depicting historical figures who at the time were out of fashion, or when he draws a woman in a way that goes against the established norms, even though the people of power are happy to indulge in some really, really, really blatant objectification. Like, the fifth woman in the film, she is... first see her as part of this ridiculous ritual where a local lord hires a bunch of women to strip down to their undergarments and go swimming.
Yep, and they go fishing, and it's basically like a wet t-shirt contest.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is... Ugh.
Yeah.
It's not enjoyable.
No. It's actively really uncomfortable. And Utamaro himself is into it. For all that he is perhaps the most aware and thoughtful man in the film, he is still very much a part of the society that...
He's a product of the society. Like, he he's more caring towards women, but at the same time, he doesn't fully like empathize with like the plight of women.
No.
He's doing better than other men, but he's still a part of the problem.
Yeah, exactly. He tends to treat things very, very lightly, so much so that when consequences happen, he is not prepared to handle them at all. I mean, he laughs off that challenge in the beginning and gets an apprentice out of it, but when he finds himself caught up in a romantic entanglement that he can't laugh his way out of or talk the woman on the other end into letting go, he finds himself hit with a massive wave of writer's block that just all but eats him alive until his friends go, "Hey, tomorrow, come participate in some voyeurism with us."
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but one of the biggest things in this movie that really stuck out to me was usually we go over the plot, but this isn't very like a straightforward plot, so we can just kind of take it vignette by vignette.
Yeah, it's a series of episodes.
But the major thing to me that stuck out was I love how like people were framed in a scene. Like, it wasn't just like people standing around, like you could tell. Like, it was, to me, it felt kind of like about like a ballet to an extent, or just the way people would move and like position themselves and then move like within the frame. It felt very specific and very structured, but at the same time, it did feel organic. Like, it didn't feel artificial.
It's careful. I love that you pointed it out because it kind of clarifies for me one of the things I was taken by in the filmmaking, in that while Mizoguchi generally doesn't use a moving camera and generally prefers to go for the God's eye room-sized view, he really pays particular attention to the way people react to each other and to how, this is going to sound redundant, but how physical body language can be. You know, Utamaro is towards the end of the movie when he's been punished for creating bad art by being locked in handcuffs for 50 days. He is just bent over double and all but curled into the fetal position when they finally come off. And in the background, his friends are all getting ready to party the night away in celebration of their friend, one, not being dead, and two, having his livelihood back. But he's just barely functional and kind of springs into desperate action when he can finally draw again.
Yeah, to me, I felt like in the third act, when he was punished for creating populist art, he, earlier, like, in the movie with his art, and you see him drawing, that was how he expressed his emotions. And then once he was not allowed to draw anymore, he became noticeably more emotional and more reactionary.
And it takes a physical toll on him because when we first meet him, he is by far the hippest man in Japan. I mean, he's wearing a hipster scarf hundreds of years before hipster scarfs were a thing.
He's
the only man to be wearing a hipster scarf. But even though he very deliberately lives a humble life, one of his quotes to his student is, "If you can only paint with expensive tools, then you're not an artist." He certainly has a need for comfort and control. And so when he loses control over not just his livelihood, but the core of his being, he starts degenerating towards the end. He looks a bit like he's about ready to go on a 6-day bender with Nicolas Cage in Las Vegas.
Yeah, like,
I mean, that is some serious stubble of despair going on.
Yeah, and I like that the a good visual cue of that is he's clean shaven for most of it, and then once he can't shave anymore, that's like he's suddenly a different person.
Yeah, he's manic in a way that he really isn't beforehand, even in the midst of his depressive episode partway through the movie when he starts rolling around on his floor completely and utterly unable to draw because he can't get, let me pull her name here. I'm just going to go online and pull the names of the five women. Since if we're talking about a filmmaker who treated women like they were people, we should probably actually have the women mentioned by name.
Yeah. That's the art rival's fiance was Yuki.
Yes. And then there was she's the woman who gets tattooed.
Yeah, she's a courtesan. And then there's Okita. She is, I guess, that's another prostitute.
She is the one who sets off Udamaro's major depressive episode.
Yeah.
He has had a thing for her for a long time, but being someone who lives to paint, every woman everywhere, that thing never really becomes what either of them might want it to be. She's the one who ends up committing murder.
I saw it more like a father-daughter type relationship, not romantic necessarily.
Interesting. I mean, for me, it was when it became something that might have become romantic when he goes to see her partway through the film and she outright refuses to speak to him, so much so that she basically clears out the entire brothel and just leaves him there.
Yeah. I feel like watching it again would be a really good. Okay, so I just realized something. Me and Joel usually do a connection segment, kind of like Next Picture Show type deal. But Joel's not here, so I'm going to save pretty much all that, except for one thing. The character, the main female character from the Kurosawa movie, No Regrets for Our Youth, is named Yuki. Hmm. And there's a Yuki who is a main character in this movie, which...
who comes from a social class that Kurosawa might normally have addressed in a way that Mizoguchi does not. Yeah. She is one of the very few upper-middle-class characters in this film, not counting her ex-fiancé, who very pointedly dumps that to go become a hipster.
The other two women are Auron, who is the woman that catches the biggest fish at the t-shirt contest that he obsesses over.
Yep.
And there's Oshin, or Oshim, depending on where you look it up.
She becomes engaged, his friend. She's the one who has... it takes a whole lot of nonsense from that guy.
Yes, he is kind of like a very childish, like, romance going on there.
Yeah, it's almost a real life version of, well, we're the spare couple, let's go sleep together in a room elsewhere.
Yeah. Oh, but the actress who played Okita is Kinoyo Tanaka. She was in several Mizoguchi films. She was in a couple Kurosawa movies. She was in a bunch of Ozu stuff. And she's the first Japanese woman to direct a feature film.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and Ozu helped her get the opportunity. And she directed, I think, about 5 or 6 films. And then she kind of stopped at a certain point. I'm not sure why. And she died in 1977, I've seen her in some, like, Ozu silent movies, so she'd been around for a long time. So in this movie, like, getting her was kind of a big deal, because she was, they were friends, but, like, she was a big name to get.
Yeah, especially you know, in this period, we're getting a movie made at all, let alone a historical epic, would not have been an easy thing to do. Something that came up in my research bomb was that for a guy who could be as infamously temperamental and demanding as Mizoguchi, he was also really good at being charming and convincing and really, really good at wheedling what he wanted out of people, which is part of how he was able to get Utamaro made in the first place.
I feel like this part of what got this made was having it be critical of traditional Japanese values, and the Americans looked at it like, hey, this is different than all the other ones.
Yeah, it's not just a film where the main character isn't a samurai. The one character who even considers himself a samurai is ridiculous and quits being a samurai within the first 20 minutes of the film, and gets so much out of it that he actually says, man, I feel so much better than not carrying a sword anymore.
Oh, yeah, I felt like that's probably for our censors, too. But, yeah.
It certainly fits with his character, who just...
Yeah.
It's one thing to admire your rival's art to the point where you reconsider what you've been doing, but he really is kind of a clueless git. I mean,
he just seemed like a rich kid who's kind of going with whatever his newest obsession is.
Yeah, I mean, when Yuki seeks him out by going alone to the poor part of town in the middle of the night as a wealthy woman, which everyone is a little shocked she did in the first place, she tries to bare her heart to him. First, she doesn't even get to see him at all, because Okita is keeping him as part of a jealousy sting against the lover who spurned her. And then, when Utamaro himself tries to get his apprentice to just come out and talk to the person who very clearly loves him dearly, he's like, well, if she wants to be the wife of a poor artist, I'll come and see her. Oh my gosh, this... I have run into Austinites like this dude.
No, I've encountered very few hipsters, but the hipsterness of that guy was a bit grating.
He didn't even have a beautiful scarf, so he's a type of hipster
or not,
who listens to Macklemore.
Yeah, he didn't have a fancy mustache either.
Nope.
Is that still a hipster thing? I don't even know.
Sometimes. There certainly is a contingent of Austinites who are very, very proud of their facial hair and all its permutations. And to be fair, I've grown a beard since I moved here, but you're also never going to see me curling a mustache. That's just not going to happen.
I cannot grow a mustache because there's a spot right above my lip where it never connects, so it would look very stupid.
Yeah, in that case, you're kind of left with one option, and that's an option no one takes, the Hitler stash.
It can't be Hitler stash because it won't connect.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, I was thinking it was on a different... Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, it was just like two separate bars. Like I shaved them in the middle. It's like, no, just hair doesn't grow there, and it would look weird.
Yeah. I mean, in my case... It's mostly pretty even, but it's, like, three different colors, which is kind of weird.
Hmm.
Yeah. Like, all my gray hair so far has gone to the beard. There's a good amount of dark brown, which is my primary hair color. And my mom tells me I got this from my granddad, there's also a bit of red, which isn't really present anywhere else.
Hmm, that's weird.
Yeah. Well, if I ever become a pirate, I can claim Redbeard as a valid name.
Yeah, you can be, like, the next Redbeard.
Yeah, I'll become the Terror of the Seas in a 700s-era galleon, and probably won't go very far as a pirate. Never mind that Austin is more or less landlocked.
Now you can go a Galveston.
True. Although, from what I understand, even a pirate would steer clear of Galveston these days. It's apparently... had a rough few years.
No. You can be like a Robin Hood of the sea.
I'm amazed that isn't a movie yet.
I'm sure there's probably like an Errol Flynn thing that's not available anymore. They made a lot of movies in Hollywood back in the day. Like most of like I'm amazed that the amount that's actually available now.
Especially given how little care was taken early on.
Yeah, like Utamaro, the film version on Filmstruck, which is the only place you can watch it, is not the greatest.
No, it's it's kind of a blurry image, and there is some very obvious grain damage.
Oh yeah, I've seen plenty of like foreign Japanese movies that are not Kurosawa, where usually it's like if it's not Kurosawa, then you're not going to get a good version of it.
I mean, one of the series at my job is dedicated to showing stuff, usually foreign films, that was only ever printed on VHS. And in some cases, they're in remarkably good shape for that medium, but at some point, I would really, really love to see a deep bit of film archaeology about straight-to-video cinema or low budget curiosities from the era of the video stores across the world.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff that, unlike early silent film, has a decent chance of still existing, but like early silent film, may only exist in damaged or incomplete forms.
Yeah.
Like, to tie my long, winding, semi-related tangent back into Japanese cinema, the amazing What's It Lady Battle Cop, which I can only describe as what would happen if you tried to combine RoboCop with, like, Power Rangers Sentai and a bizarre attempt at commentary on American militarism, which mostly seems to involve a very Japanese man playing like a General Ripper type and his sidekick who I'd swear was O.J. Jackson at this movie. O.J. Simpson. How the hell did I get O.J. Jackson? The evil goon in this movie looks like O.J. Simpson. And if it wasn't made in the early 90s, I think it might actually have been O.J. Simpson. But
I want reviews for my blog.
It's amazing.
I can't remember the name of the series, but it's based off a manga called, like, Yo-Yo Girl, and it's about this delinquent teen girl who has a steel yo-yo.
I've heard of it.
And she gets recruited by a police, and there are four movies made,
like,
adapted from it. I own the two from the 80s, and there's one from, like, maybe 2012, and one from, like, a year after that.
Yeah. There was a period there in the mid-2000s where a whole bunch of vintage 70s manga and anime were getting live-action adaptations. Like, I think that's part of... That's around when Hideaki Anno did that Cutie Honey movie, which was, I think, one of the first things he did after Hideaki Anno's second or third major emotional breakdown. But
Cutie Honey was covered on Joel's podcast, Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, episode, I think, 28?
I'll have to look that up.
It's one of the Cutie Honey things. But I know they covered it way early on.
Yeah.
About 100 episodes ago on Please Don't Send Me Outer Space. But back to Utamaro.
After that lengthy and baffling tangent.
Yeah, without Joel here, I tend to allow things like that. But whatever, he's not here.
Well, I tend to ramble, so apologies.
It's fine. I don't mind going off of, like, a dumb tangent that's not related.
Because movies where the theme song is about women playing tennis have so much to do with movies about one of Japan's great artists one of Japan's great artists.
Yeah,
it's interesting to me that You know, this is very much a biopic, but in the decades since it was made, the language of that form has changed so much. There is not really a beginning to ending narrative here. There is certainly narrative movement, especially once Utamaro is punished by the Japanese government.
Yeah. Like, but for me, the flow of the story didn't really kick in until maybe 30 minutes in. I was like, oh, okay, it's just like a bunch of vignettes. It's not a straightforward thing. And then I started to like it more.
Yeah, it's incidents in the life of this major circle figure, creating context for his work, as well as using his work to explore Mizoguchi's favorite themes and ongoing interests in the women of Japan.
Yeah, I'm just kind of skipping ahead, but I would recommend this, but it's not my favorite Mizoguchi. My favorite one is probably Women of the Night, which is one he did 2 years later. And Women of the Night is definitely more bleak and kind of unpleasant in certain ways, but like this in some ways feel like a precursor to Women of the Night almost, except it's kind of classier, where Women of the Night is kind of weirdly, not trashy, but it's like it's a bit of a like a B-movie departure in certain aspects from...
There's a bit of a layer of sleaze on it?
Yeah, a little bit of a layer of sleaze, as much as you could do in 48, but...
Yeah. I mean, there's a large number of topless women from behind in this, so... Mizoguchi was certainly someone subject to the male gaze. No, that's...
Yeah.
His gaze was certainly the male gaze. That makes more sense.
But I noticed like I gotta find where I noticed exactly. He injected like sexuality in certain scenes. Like there's when, where is it?
More or less, any time he is working with a model and talking with her, that is where I found the film moved into the realms of sensuality and sexuality. The obvious one is the big tattoo scene, which is...
Yeah, and he's acting all nervous, and is like, can I touch her skin? Her skin is so beautiful. And it's like, can I just stop talking about her skin? This is weird.
Yeah, and like, guys... Move on. You were hired to tattoo this woman. Tattoo this woman.
And so at first I thought the woman was like was royalty or something. That's like, oh, she's just like a higher class prostitute. She's not really royalty at all, Leas.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of Madonna whoring going on towards the women in this film. They are simultaneously assumed by the men around them to be perfectly compliant to their whims, and yet if they act in a way that it does not match that desire exactly, especially if it might in other respects, the big one for me being Yuki being deeply and sincerely devoted to asshole Japanese woodblock hipster. They're dismissed and cast out.
He doesn't think of her, period.
No.
And she's endlessly devoted, and she stays endlessly devoted. Although I like the thing of she gets a job at a certain point, and it shows that she's trying to move on, and like her, and that's a clear sign of like her father just owned her. They don't really say that, but I kind of figured like they're hinting at, like, her father disowned her and won't pay for anything anymore.
Yeah, I mean, she outright refuses to go back, even when Captain Hipster spurns her. And Udamaru himself is genuinely shocked by this. You know, at first he thinks that she's going to take the Hipster up on his offer of being a common wife, which is being married to a commoner. That's a better way to put it.
Yeah,
but she doesn't. But she will not go back to the culture that spurned someone she cared about for pursuing a different path than had been laid out.
Yeah, and so back to the the hidden drawing being code for like sex. There's the when he's peeping when all he and his friends, not just him, his friends are peeping under women fishing.
Yep.
That
is totally like that is one pair of orange hot pants away from being medieval Japanese Hooters.
Yeah. And notably most of the women are wearing white when they're going in the water. Which, yep, I understand what they're getting at. But
yep.
When he sees Auron and she gets a big fish and he's like fumbling to get his pen out to like start drawing her, and it's like, yep, I get the metaphor that you're going for. I understand.
Yes. You have used this phallic object in a fashion that suggests what you wanted to suggest. Let's continue. Acclaimed Japanese director who is amongst the greatest artists of all time.
He is, but like this is just like, but I feel like given the censors, that's kind of the best he could do. Because this is 46, under MacArthur, they was still pretty strict with like what you can and can't do.
Moreover, I think he may have been limited by the format he chose, because you and I have talked about this a bit. This is a very unusual film structurally.
Yeah, it's most like movies, period, at this time are not vignette based. Most of them are like A to B type plot. This is a huge departure. Feels kind of ahead of its time. Like, I can't think of any older movie than this that is so kind of scatterbrained in terms of like a plot.
Yeah, I mean, there would have been like early experimental stuff, but in terms of narrative film, anything I can think of that would be more digressive would be really, really early stuff when the medium was being figured out in its infancy.
Does M count?
I don't know M. My knowledge of Fritz Lang begins and ends with the various versions of Metropolis,
Because M kind of is like vignettes around a serial killer who's killing children.
Yeah, and Metropolis itself does have detours and digressions, especially in the recovered cut. Like, there's this whole bit where a character who the main character becomes a body double for, basically takes over the film for about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, there is the ongoing narrative drive of the conflict between the workers and the owners. And while there is absolutely conflict in Udamaru, it's present more or less all throughout the film. It's much, much calmer isn't the proper term, but it's much more languid and willing to go off in directions that another story might not.
I think that's also correct, too. This was like 25 years or so into his career, so he probably felt comfortable slash was like, why not I just do this and see what happens?
Yeah, moreover, it was the first film he'd made in, you know, 6 years. The last one had been this massive historical epic. If
oh, yeah, 47 Ronin. It's 4 hours long, maybe 4.5 hours long. Me and Joel have thought about covering it, but we're like, it's just too much movie to cover.
Yeah, that is an investment. That is a multi-part episode right there.
Yeah,
but, to make a facile comparison, this is his chef to 47 Ronin's Iron Man 2. And I'm going to go throw myself into the sea for making a comparison.
Wait, so Iron Man 2 is 47 Ronin?
A big, expensive, comparatively epic film.
Oh, okay, yeah, I got it now.
Not the best analogy.
I get what you're going for now. It took a few seconds to process.
I could have chosen a better example.
it's fine. But, I don't feel like even doing, a minimal, plot overview, because it's not really it won't clear things up or anything. It's just there, we kind of discuss the plot in various segments, because that's how it's presented. But there, so usually in, oh, I just found a note, I forgot, there's a, at the end when Okita kills her fiance, her ex-fiance, and the tattoo woman, Aoru. There's a part where all a bunch of the women are at Udamara's house, and they kind of hint, basically say modeling for you was the best thing I did in my life. It was freeing. It helped me feel like myself in this very wonderful moment.
A degree of immortality, and more immediately, it is proof of their existence in a society and world that would very quickly replace them and discard them and see them disappear for their own convenience.
Yeah, and they they don't say it out loud, but it allowed them to be express their sexuality the way they wanted to express it. It let them, feel beautiful, and not that you had to feel beautiful, but it helped them just feel self-esteem for once in a world where, in their world, that's just not the case.
No. And based on the reading I've done on Mizoguchi elsewhere, he would return time and again to the way that women were disempowered and encouraged to think of themselves as little as possible. But here, I would say, for all that we have talked about how discursive and rambling a film this is, what gives it a central through line for me is the relationship Udamaro has to his art and to his subjects, and that they have to his art and to a much lesser extent him himself, since the women are more interested in engaging with Udamaro than they are necessarily in the idea of Udamaro as a romantic figure or as someone to desire. He is he is a peer in a way that the women we meet do not get to have very many male friends like. It's
That's only platonic relationships they really have. Despite some of the weird, like, sexual politics of it, I shouldn't say weird.
1946 in Japan.
Yeah, it's 1946 in Japan, so it's a different time, a different place. Like, take that for what it is. It's not the worst I've seen. I've seen much worse, but... But, you know, it's... If that keeps away from the movie, it's not... That doesn't get in the way as much as we may it seem. It's just... There are a couple moments where it's like, ugh.
This is salacious. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And usually we would do... We pick other 1946 movies that we've seen... That we want to recommend. And for me, I don't have any because I haven't seen anything except for Song of the South, which has its own weird, complex history. I barely remember it, but I've come to have a weird appreciation for it in certain ways because it inspired a movie that I've been very obsessed with for pretty much maybe two or three years. I mean, we've talked
was
about
that here. The Ralph Bakshi one?
Uh-huh, Coonskin.
Yeah.
That's basically...
I've read some of your work on that, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Coonskin is a... basically like Song of the South, but what if it's set in 1970s New York? More or less. And... And Ralph Bakshi made it, and he's commenting on race in America, and he's calling out Disney for being racist in a couple very huge scenes. But it's... Song of South is just a very odd movie, because it also produced the... Arguably the most famous Disney song, Zippity Doodah. In case you didn't know, that's where it came from.
Yeah, like... The context for... Like, the Br'er Rabbit cartoons, I think I actually have either had a storybook featuring those characters as a child, and I have definitely heard that song at the Disney parks, and at least one of their major, major attractions is based on those cartoons. But, like, just admit your failings, release the movie, give it context... Burying it isn't going to do anyone any good.
I've been to Disney World. You said you've been to some Disney parks. Like, they still... It's like they still have, like, aspects of it at the park.
Isn't Big Splash Mountain?
Yes,
like,
it is.
One of their biggest rides, and that's from Song of the South.
Yes, it is.
Well,
and Song of the South starred two... Oscar winners. One is James Baskett, who played Uncle Remus, or Rufus. What is it?
Definitely not Uncle Ruckus, but
I don't say Ruckus, but that's someone else.
Yeah, that's the terrifying guy from the Boondocks who like routinely harasses Huey.
Yeah, he's a real. Wait, no, he's not Uncle Tom. Tom's Uncle Tom. Anyway, James Baskett won an Oscar in 1948 because the Academy saw Song of the South as a very important film. I don't know that context, but he did win an honorary Oscar, and he died later that year, and Hattie McDaniels was in it, and she won an Oscar for the Civil War movie that I always think is... the movie with the singing nuns and the Nazis. Why is that? Gone with the Wind. Yes.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I love most about UT's campus. We have an archive called the Harry Ransom Center that has accumulated a great deal of material from various filmmakers over the years. And one of our first major acquisitions was the David O. Selznick archive, which included basically every single document he kept about Gone with the Wind's production. So if you visit the Ransom Center, the exhibit itself closed a few years back, but you know, if you're doing research, you can get access to the archives, and that includes at least a few of the original paintings for the design work in that movie, and there is still a giant book for sale that talks about the making of Out the Wind and all its in all its absurd complexities. Like, let me put it this way. The Titanic movie sells like wanted to make that would involve sinking an actual goddamn ocean liner as part of the production. Less complicated than getting Gone with the Wind made.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah. And the book itself, my former editor-in-chief, Meredith Boyer, she reviewed it. It also outright engages with the rampaging racism of the master text. So it's definitely something I want to check out. And I guess I can go ahead and recommend something from 1946 myself, since I pulled up 1946 in film on Wikipedia.
I want to mention one more thing about Song Herself in Train's Basket. So, you know Dumbo has the crows in it?
Yep.
So James Basket did one of the voices of the crows, and after I did a whole bunch of research on the Coonskin article on minstrelsy and blackface, I just always assumed the crows were white people doing black voices, and I'm frankly shocked that it wasn't just like a white person doing a black voice. It was an actual black person, which is still not great, but
yeah,
it's something.
I mean, one of the things I've been most curious about for a long time now is how much of it is independent black cinema from the early years of the art form. Mm-hmm. I know that not Turner Classic Movies, they probably aired a few. I think Kino put out a whole big box set of surviving black-made films from that era a few years back.
Who was the guy? There's some guy named Oscar. He's a black independent filmmaker who made, like, hundreds of movies between I think 1919 and early 1950s. They're really cheap, and most aren't available. But he eventually was kind of accepted into, like, Hollywood to an extent. And some people... I saw this once on the internet, so don't take it for truth. But I saw once that the Oscar is named after this one independent black filmmaker from the early Hollywood history. Well, movie history.
Yeah, if I'm remembering my Oscar trivia right, the statue itself is modeled on a Mexican actor. Like I think he posed for the original design or something. If it is who I think it is, he played the villain in Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. But and that's one of my favorite movies, but that's a story for another time. So getting back to 1946 on film, I pulled the Wikipedia article on it to look for things that I might have seen. And the second highest grossing movie of the year after Song of the South was The Best Years of Our Lives, which I'll tie into tomorrow by noting that it was a film directly impacted by post-war culture. The director... Internet.
I've heard of this movie, but I don't know really anything about it.
William Wyler was one of...
I know that name, but I'm not sure why.
He was one of the big names in 40s American cinema, and he was one of several major directors who worked as filmmakers for the U.S. government during World War II. It's the subject of Mark Harris's great book, Five Came Back. And each of these directors was dramatically shaped by what they witnessed and experienced in World War II. You know, even the famously arrogant and egomaniacal John Ford you know, he was the man to film the Battle of Midway as it was happening. And he was very, very shaken by the deaths of several pilots who he had befriended in his time making a documentary about the military presence there. So he went and made several short films for their families, gave those films to them, and then never told anyone, which is, given who John Ford was, shocking.
John Ford is also Kurosawa's hero in terms of, like, filmmaking. And he apparently, Kurosawa was such a fan of John Ford, he researched the exact type of clothes he would wear on set. And for a time, he would wear the types of clothes that he would wear on set when he was filming
the movie. I think I've seen a few photos where that's definitely the case.
Yeah, he was pretty much like that. That was like his idol when it came to this filmmaking, because he loved American movies.
Yeah. I mean, best years of our lives, William Wyler. And Wyler was one of the older men in Harris's book. Partially deafened after the war, but because he was filming something from a strato bomber and like a bomb went off right outside the plane or some such. So he went up directing for the rest of his life, partially deaf and using a massive early hearing aid. But Best Years of Our Lives is, like Utamaro, a deliberately episodic story following three men who return from the war. One is a middle-aged banker. The other is a young man who basically had no life before the war, found purpose in it, and has no idea what to do now that he's back, especially since the girlfriend he married on the spur of the moment, because of the whole, hey, I might get killed thing, turns out they're a horrible match for each other, and neither is happy with the arrangement, but because of the social mores of the time, divorce is not an option, or at least not a respectable option.
It didn't happen. My grandpa's parents got divorced when he was, I think, 5. And this was been like the late 30s. And it was kind of reportedly very difficult for them to even get that done.
Yeah. One of the major plot points in Best Years is that the heroine explicitly attempts to break up this guy's marriage, and Wyler had to fight tooth and nail for that to happen, because the censors were appalled that she would do this and remain a sympathetic, likable character. I think the thing the movie is probably most famous for is that its third star, Harold Russell, he lost both of his hands in an accident on a ship, and played a character who had also lost both of his hands. He's one of a depressingly small number of disabled actors to play a genuinely disabled character who shares his disability. And, you know, not a professional actor, didn't appear very often after this film, won 2 Oscars for it. I think Best Supporting and a special award that was only given out that year. But
yeah, I think 46 was, they're still doing like the junior Oscars for children actors, and this may have been when Julie Garland won her only Oscar, which was like a kid, and won for like kid actors.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other podcast right there, the strange history of the Oscars.
Yeah,
I will say, if you should watch Utamaro and His 5 Women and be curious how other filmmakers were impacted by the war and wanted to address social issues, if in a very different national and cultural context, take 3 hours and watch The Best Years of Our Lives. It's a really, really, really wonderful film.
Is it easily available?
It is, fortunately. Okay. It's one of the very few archive films that can be reliably counted on to appear on disc media. It's like really, really astonishing how many acclaimed films have all but vanished in the past few years just because of the strange mutations media consumption has gone through.
Yeah, like every time there's a new format, you lose a bunch of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that was only on VHS that is pretty much gone forever.
Yeah, never mind Betamax or other less successful mediums or, the straight to DVD or straight to video, that format has bounced around into a whole ton of different incarnations. It's where Scott Adkins does most of his work, and it's where
Wasn't
movies that
he
people.
in a Marvel movie?
Yeah, he plays Mads Mikkelsen's chief goon in Doctor Strange, and for once actually gets to use his incredible martial arts skill in a mainstream movie. Like, he popped up in Zero Dark Thirty as guy who gets blown up,
All
and
right.
he was in. He had the grave misfortune of being not Deadpool in that awful Wolverine movie. Like, they swapped out Ryan Reynolds for him because he needed a stunt person. I think he was in that American Assassin thing, and he somehow gets beaten up by Teen Wolf guy, which I'm just not having at all.
Well, it's a movie.
True, but still. And yeah.
Got any others from 1946, or is that kind of it? I'm not.
Well,
I don't. I don't. I'm not really big on old Hollywood in general, but I haven't. But I haven't seen. I've barely seen any like old Hollywood movies to begin with, really.
if nothing else, I would say check out Five Came Back, and it's both a book and a Netflix three-part documentary, which has the advantage of having access to a great deal of the footage the five filmmakers shot during the war. Meryl Streep narrates. And it what makes the book it's the book so much fun to read is that Harris has a real knack for taking separate narratives and building a master narrative out of them. Frank Capra was doing wildly different things from George Stevens during the war. Capra was in Washington trying to figure out how to sell people in the war without being horrendously racist and frankly not succeeding at all. Basically, he was given the assignment. From what I understand, it looked like this: Frank, we need you to sell American citizens on Germany as the enemy, but make sure that Germans aren't all bad people. I, Frank Capra, can do that. This is what Frank Capra sounded like, but I'm going to give him a ridiculous accent. Frank, we need to do the same with the Japanese people. Beat. Fuck. I'm going to fail this completely. And George Stevens, meanwhile, before the war, beloved as a director of sweetheart and romantic comedies, and then the poor guy got tapped to document the concentration camps for the war crime trials.
Oh.
And after that, he made Shane, one of the most famous anti-violence movies in history.
Who was
It
it?
was.
Wasn't it Clark Gable? Was briefly in the war, but then the studio convinced the army to send him back to Hollywood.
That sounds right.
There's some male sex symbol who was drafted.
Yeah. I know Bogart, I think he actually did have some combat time, but he was given leave on a few occasions to go make propaganda films. That's how we got Sahara, which is a wonderful movie. I don't think that was 46, but it's Humphrey Bogart is an American tank commander in the middle of the African front who winds up on he and his small tank crew wind up on this windy turny journey throughout the African desert, picking up various they rescue a stranded African soldier, they capture a sweetheart Italian and a sinister German. The Italian comes to their side, the German gets strangled by the African soldier. And they find some British people too. It turns into this massive siege where they're trying to essentially trick the entire German army into wasting their time on trying to kill this one tiny tank brigade while the majority of the Allied front advances elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while there, it looks like it's heading for, at best, a bittersweet ending. And then they actually trick the German army into surrendering almost by accident. Like, there's this moment where, like, Bogart mm-hmm. and, like, Bogart's only, like, one of maybe five people, like, two people left alive. They're getting ready for the final stand. The Germans are marching on them and throwing down their weapons and raising their hands and begging to be taken prisoner. What's going on?
Hmm.
It's a really wonderful film.
Huh. Yeah, I do want to watch it. I do like Bogart. I've seen him in Sabrina and Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Oh, Sierra Madre is amazing.
Yeah, it's great. But there's this, this should be brought up. I think me and Joel brought up maybe last episode. There is a second Kurosawa movie from 1946 called Those Who Make Tomorrow that is basically impossible to find, and there's one review on Letterboxd that is the film has never been seen outside of Japan since its release. So who are these 44 people who said they watched it? If they did, let me know where you can find a print.
It says here on Wikipedia, which is never wrong, that Kurosawa mm-hmm. does not mention he made this film.
Yeah, I saw that too, that he just doesn't talk, he never talked about it. So, I want to see it. I've heard legend of it for years now, and I just want to see this movie.
Presumably it still exists? Question mark?
I don't know, it's never been released on VHS or Betamax or anything.
At least, it's in an archive somewhere.
Yeah. Like, in Japan, never left.
Yeah.
Alright, so we should probably close up. So, you have stuff, anything to plug that you're coming up or you've done?
Well, you can find my writing on Birth, Movies, Death. I contribute there semi-regularly. I most recently had a piece on Alex Garland and his use of ensemble casts to tie into Annihilation's release. Oh. And early next week, I'll have a piece up on the one part of Sin City, A Dame to Kill For that I think is actually a good movie.
I've watched the first 5 minutes, and then I had something to do, and I never got back to it.
It's an interesting failure. But if you're going to watch any of it, just watch Joseph Gordon-Levitt's last scene. You can leave the rest. but, like, for one brief moment, it feels like the Frank Miller of the 80s and 90s took this bit of story, put it in a bottle, and hurled it into the future where xenophobic old jerk-ass Frank Miller found it and was like, hey, Robert Rodriguez, let's put this in our movie.
Oh, yeah, I forgot they're friends.
They have perhaps the single most baffling cameo I've ever seen by any creators in any movie ever. They appear as bums in alleyway, mumbling incoherently at each other on television. And the entire thing might just be something, just like Alba's character is hallucinating. So either Mumble Bums is Sin City's most popular show, or Jessica Alba's hallucinations are weirdly mundane. And come this May, I will have two pieces in the upcoming collector's issue for Avengers Infinity War. So when that goes up for pre-order, I'll put a link up.
All right. Yeah, when... I lost my thought there. Yeah, I'll put a link to that when a link is available. Just let me know.
And it won't be for a few months yet, but I'll send you a link for my writing, question mark?
Yeah, I can put on the episode.
Cool.
Text
Thank
stuff.
You.
You're welcome. Yeah. And for me, I have Jailhouse 701. I've just I'm going through the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series, which, have you seen those?
I know of them, I have not seen them.
I think you would like them a lot. It's very dense Yakuza drama, and it's based off of the Yakuza Wars in Hiroshima from 1946 to 1970.
Was that
And
this? Was the filmmaker the same person who made Battle Royale late in life, or was that someone else?
same guy.
Thought so.
Yeah,
I'm
he's.
interested.
Yeah, I like his older stuff more than his late era stuff, personally.
Battle
But.
Royale is the only thing of his I know, but I liked it enough that I'm intrigued by his other work.
Yeah, I highly recommend Battles Without Honor and Humanity, or the Yakuza Papers, depending on your translation. It's a very dense, very violent, very bleak series that also has a very dark sense of humor. Like, there's a joke in the first one where a character cuts off half his finger because he disrespected his boss, his boss, and then his boss says, "Boss, this last time's like that. You didn't have to do that."
Okay, I gotta see this.
They're all streaming on Amazon right now and on DVD.
Excellent.
Yes. There are 8 movies. I'm only doing the first 5 because the last 3 are new Battles with Honor and Humanity. So I'm not going to do those yet. And for Samurai Knife Fight, I just reviewed The Victim, a TV movie from the 70s starring Elizabeth Montgomery from Bewitched. And she fights off a killer, and she's trapped in a house, and it's pretty good. Read my review. That's a good indication if you want to actually watch it. It's on YouTube if you're curious. And I was on The Grind Bin, episode 74, talking about Coonskin. I have a review of Coonskin up on The Grind Bin podcast website.
You should read it. It's good work.
Oh, thank you. I did so much research into like watching old Black Place clips. It doesn't bother me anymore, which kind of freaks me out that I've seen so much.
It's disturbingly omnipresent.
Oh yeah, it's still that culture still exists now. We pretend like it doesn't. And yeah, that's it. Joel will be back for our next episode, which, oh, I didn't even look ahead. Okay, damn it, I forgot what the next pairing is. Okay, I'm looking up on Google. I took off the Google stuff on my phone so I won't be distracted as much, which has helped.
Cool. I think I'm coming back for Throne of Blood whenever you guys do that.
Yeah, that will be in August, I think.
Cool.
I can move stuff around if you want it sooner. It's all kind of vague at this point.
Whatever works for you, whenever works for you.
Yeah.
And
Okay, I found. Oh, sorry.
when and if I get either my podcasts up and running, I'd love to have you on.
Oh, yeah, I would. Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. Let's see.
Yay.
If you do like cheap action movies, there's a whole lot of like Japanese stuff that comes out that's
Oh,
really
yes.
bizarre and fascinating.
I reiterate, Lady Battle Cop.
Let's see. Okay, so the next pairing episodes will be 1965's Red Beard, the final Kurosawa with Toshiro in it, and 1965's An Innocent Witch. And we have Innocent Witch is on Filmstruck. Redbeard is on Filmstruck. It might be streaming on Amazon. I don't. You can never tell with Criterion and Amazon right now. But yeah, Redbeard is a 3-hour epic that's totally worth watching. And we will have Chris Funderburg and John Cribbs from The Pink Smoke coming back for that episode too. If you don't read The Pink Smoke, you definitely should. It's a great website. I like Chris and John. And yeah, so that's it. Hashtag thug life, not die forever.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for your time.
All right. See all you fine people on internet land, elsewhere on the great big world wide web. I stopped recording. Did that?
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening.